From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and we're following all the news today from the disappointing jobs report to Hurricane Joaquin, which looks like it will not hit the U.S., so at least some good news there.
Meanwhile, let's address something President Obama said last night, that mass shootings, like the one in Oregon last night, have become routine. The website The Mass Shooting Tracker reports that in the 274 days this year, there have been 294 mass shootings. Now, they define a mass shooting as four or more people killed or wounded. And by that calculation, the Washington Post reports 380 people have been killed this year. Mother Jones has also been tracking mass shootings through its downloadable database, A Guide to Mass Shootings in America. National Affairs editor Mark Fulman joins us now. Now, Mark, you use a definition without the wounded, four or more people killed. Start there. What else defines a mass shooting for you?
Yes, so there are a number of criteria that go into this, and I think there's been considerable confusion. The four more killed, whether or not that includes the shooter is one issue. We do not include the shooter in our count, as is the case with the FBI. But what we really focused on, Robin, with this data work, which we've been working on this database for 3.5 years now, analyzing these attacks going back to 1982, is we're really focused on these events that take place in public venues, mm-hmm. like the attack we saw yesterday in Oregon at a college, a university, at a K-12 school, in a shopping mall, in a movie theater.
You do say that there are some exceptions. There was a party on a private property in Crandon, Wisconsin that saw a mass shooting, another in Seattle. But basically, it has to occur in a public place.
That's right. And that goes to the point that there really is no perfect or official definition of what a mass shooting is. It's something that's been debated by criminologists and others who study the issue. In some ways, the data set that we've built is very conservative. We don't include cases that involve motives like armed robbery or criminal gang violence. And we also don't include cases that are based on domestic violence that take place in private homes. And there are many, many mass shootings like that, far more, in fact, than what we see in public venues.
So let's be clear about that. These horrible, you know, whole families being wiped out and sometimes murder-suicides, those shooting incidents, those are not included.
That's right. Not in our study, which was we were really trying to understand how often is this problem taking place where someone walks into a public setting and kills people seemingly indiscriminately. And what we found is that that has increased quite a bit in the last few years. Going back to 1982, there's been a public mass shooting like this about once every 200 days up until 2011. And since 2011, the frequency has tripled to an attack about once every 64 days. Yeah. With the attack yesterday, we've seen 20 of these now since 2011, when the attack took place in Tucson, in which former Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords and 18 others were shot.
And so you're seeing an increase, and others, Harvard University and the FBI, both corroborate that, an increase in these kinds of mass shootings, four more people killed, usually a lone shooter, in public, and sometimes those so-called spree killings, as awful as that sounds, but somebody who's gone from one location to another. But tell us more about who is doing the shooting.
Right. So I think one thing that gets lost in the debate about frequency are there are several things. One is that the vast majority of these attackers use legally acquired guns, more than 80% of the cases. The majority of them are white males, and many of them suffer from serious mental health issues. But there's almost no way to predict who's going to go on a rampage like this.
You mentioned that most of the weapons used in the mass killings have been legal. But you also write that many of them would have been illegal if the assault weapons ban of 2013 had been renewed.
Yes, I think that's a complicated point because there's no clear evidence that the assault weapons ban would have prevented these kinds of attacks either. There were a number of attacks during that time period when that law was in effect. But the kinds of weapons that that legislation outlawed are overwhelmingly the kinds of weapons that these attackers use, which is to say semi-automatic handguns with large capacity magazines and semi-automatic assault rifles like an AR-15, like the kind we saw in Newtown, in Aurora, and on and on.
So you've told us there have been at least three of these mass shootings, four or more people killed in this year. Then you have the mass shooting tracker. They found 294 mass shootings where four more people were killed or injured. So in other words, 294 up from three when you include four or more people injured in mass shootings. we'll let people react as they will to that tally, because that's just mass shootings. Outside of that, there have been 10,000 people killed, 20,000 wounded in nearly 40,000 gun violence incidents so far just this year.
And then and what I would just add about the criteria is with the mass shootings tracker and others who use broader definitions, it really just goes to that point that our gun violence problem is much, much bigger in this country and that these public attacks are a tiny fraction of them. But when you start to count with broader criteria, you see this problem go up exponentially. So if you look at the number of people being wounded or killed every day, you can come up with a much higher number of mass shootings. The criteria of four or more people killed, there's been a recent shift in thinking around this in the federal government. In 2013, President Obama instructed the Justice Department to look at this problem more closely. And the Justice Department has begun to look at mass shootings like this with a baseline of three or more victims killed. And I can tell you from all of the research and reporting I've done on this subject in the last 3.5 years, when you adjust the baseline down like that, even one fatality, the number of cases we're talking about goes up big time. We're talking about hundreds more cases. So that gives you another sense of how the criteria issue works with studying this problem.
Huh. Just by going to three or more, which is in itself horrendous.
That's right.
That's Mark Fullman, National Affairs Editor at Mother Jones Magazine. We'll link you to their Guide to Mass Shootings in America at hereandnow.org. Mark, thank you.
All right. Take care.
Well, Russian defense officials said today the country's planes have conducted at least 18 airstrikes in Syria in the last 24 hours, and they continue to insist they're targeting ISIS and other extremist groups, even as evidence on the ground runs counter to that claim. The BBC spoke to survivors of a Russian attack yesterday in the town of Telbisi. That town is controlled by the Free Syrian Army, which is supported by the U.S. in its efforts to topple Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, an ally of Russia.
It was terrifying, and the destruction was one of a kind compared to what we've seen over the course of the last 4 years. This is the first time we witnessed such airstrikes. Whole residential neighborhoods devastated completely.
Kevin Barron is executive editor for Defense One. He covers the Pentagon and joins us now. And Kevin, first of all, the Russians, as we said, say they're targeting ISIS and other extremist groups. The U.S. says they're hitting rebels who are fighting ISIS. What do we know about what's actually happening in Syria?
That's about all we know. The problem with Syria for a long time has been the lack of independent eyes. So we're relying upon these official statements from Washington, at least. And that's exactly what you said. The Pentagon insists that these were not ISIS fighters. But the Pentagon won't confirm who they were because other reporting says these were actually CIA-backed or trained rebels from Syria. Other reporting thinks that these targeted strikes from Russia may not even have been that accurate, and it was really civilians and other groups as well.
So is there the risk then of a situation where you have an indirect Russian attack on the United States because these are CIA-backed rebels that Russia would be attacking?
Well, that's a bit of A plus B equals C kind of scenario. There's two different, I think, worries. One is some sort of catastrophe of a Russian plane and an American plane being in the same place at the same time and bad things happening. The other is as you were saying, are the Russians targeting rebel groups the United States has been trying to support? It's going to be messy like this for a while.
Well, let's talk about the idea of two planes coming into conflict with each other. In order to avoid something like that happening, we've been hearing people talk about the fact that the Russians and the U.S. are going to have conversations on a daily basis to make sure that their planes are not going in the same places.
And that conversation started yesterday, actually, for the first time, a one-hour-long phone call led by the Pentagon's top international security policy official, Alyssa Slotkin, and that with the promise that both parties would go back and talk over proposals of how to deconflict, that's the word of the day, the air campaign over Syria as well as over Iraq, and talk about some more within a few days.
It's clear the U.S. officials are not happy about the developments, that Russia has gotten more involved here in the conflict in Syria. But is it possible, Kevin Barron, that this involvement by Russia could force people to the negotiating table, could bring an end to this conflict that's gone on for so long now and cost so many lives?
Well, three things. Yes, I think Americans are not happy the Russians have gotten involved. Yes, it could force an end to the conflict, but perhaps not the end that the Americans, at least the Obama administration, has been calling for several years now. This is much more likely to ensure that Bashar Assad will be part of a political negotiation at some point.
And then he will stay in power?
Well, it may end up being that this could be the way to walk him out, that with Russian support and literal actual Russian air cover, he could be given some sort of sanctuary, some way out that we haven't heard talked about really since the very beginning of all this. Look, the Americans, if they wanted to, they could have, dropped bombs on Assad's head a long time ago. But they waited it out for the region to fight this battle for themselves. And I think, this was the Obama administration's containment policy. Mm. And I think the result that no one saw coming was that while they were all focused on the inside of Syria, here comes Russia from the outside to fill that void.
Kevin Barron, executive editor for the website Defense One, joining us from Washington. Kevin, thank you.
You're welcome.
Social media has seen some serious topics this week. Mike Barry is with The Guardian U.S. Mike, start for us with the shooting at Umpqua Community College. You spoke to us after the shooting at the church in Charleston, South Carolina. What stood out this time?
What I thought was really interesting about yesterday, I happened to see an Instagram search just about 45 minutes after the shooting news broke for Oregon. And the hashtag was filled with a sort of an outpouring of grief and support. That's something that we often talk about when we talk about social media and news in social media, is that people express their emotions or they respond to emotional prompts on social media when it comes to the news. Yesterday, President Obama was really railing against that.
Yeah,
he was really saying, let's get angry. He was pulling a completely different emotional string in viewers and listeners with his speech, trying to get people to essentially wake up. And interestingly enough, the video can serve as sort of a badge for gun control activists or people who believe that gun laws should be changed to take that video and sort of put it on social media themselves.
And are they doing that? Are they taking President Obama's video?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that there are two camps right now, people who feel sadness and people who feel anger about what's been going on and about sort of the phenomenon of gun violence in general. And they're taking that video and saying, this is also how I feel. I feel angry. I feel frustrated. And the words of President Obama embodied it.
Well, there's another hashtag getting a lot of attention. This is hashtag shout your abortion. Now, your paper has reported on this. This started on September 19th. A woman named Amelia Baunow posted on Facebook that she'd had an abortion at Planned Parenthood in Seattle. What she and her friend Lindy West wrote an op-ed piece for The Guardian. What they wanted to do was certainly not celebrate this, but take it out of the arena of shame and change the conversation on the part of women who were choosing abortions. And a lot of women did respond and talk about their painful decisions, but also the fact that they appreciated they had the choice. Well, then what happened?
What ended up happening was, while there was a tremendous amount of response in favor of this hashtag and women talking about their abortion experiences, there was also a tremendous amount of online harassment. Mm-hmm. And the woman who started this hashtag, or who first talked about her abortion, she is now in hiding. Mm-hmm. This is a phenomenon that is incredibly important when we talk about social media and the news. It's a phenomenon that happens to women journalists, women who write on the internet for a living or for pleasure as part of their communities. When we talk about how women are talked about on social media and, consequently in the news, we also have to talk about how women are shamed and are harassed in disproportionate numbers relative to other people on the internet. It's not simply people write on the internet and other people, because of the anonymity that the internet affords, attack them. It's that women in particular, talking about women's issues, face harassment at a level that's just simply not seen with other groups talking on the internet.
Well, let's have a last note, because we need it. It's a serious topic that turned ridiculously silly. This is comedian John Hendren, who, how to say this? He has a Twitter handle that perhaps reflects his attitude towards life. We're told we can say it. @fart. And so he was being interviewed about Edward Snowden, who famously went on Twitter for the first time this week. And what happened?
Mr. Hendren talked about Edward Scissorhands. And the clip itself is such a beautiful, shareable piece of content on social media. It's a 2-minute long video of the anchor talking about Snowden, Mr. Hendren talking about Scissorhands. And they were basically talking past each other.
Just because he was created on top of a mountain by Vincent Price and incomplete with scissors for hands and no heart, Edward Scissorhands is a complete hero to me.
But what about the choice that he made to live in a country like Russia?
I mean, where else is he going to go? You know, we cast him out. Like, we got scared when he poked a hole in a waterbed with his scissor finger. Like, that was just unreasonable of us.
Well, John, I appreciate you giving us your opinion. Thank you.
No, thanks.
What this is essentially a masterful use of what social media is. He created his own meme, and it was able to travel all over the internet. A million websites picked this up. A million people were talking about it. In my own newsroom, I just happened to walk past somebody's desk, and they were laughing uncontrollably, and I asked them what's going on. I mean, that's the very nature of how people try to self-promote on the internet. And here's a guy practicing his craft expertly.
Mike Barry is head of audience for Guardian US. As part of that, he monitors social media. Mike, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, staying with social media, by now you've probably seen the joyous, expletive-laden video of Mikey Bergen and Jay Foster fishing near Boston. They hooked what? Mike's reaction became a viral sensation. Let's listen to a heavily edited highlight clip.
That thing is big, Jay. What is that thing? It looks hurt.
I don't know.
Oh, my God. That thing looks dead, man. We got to call the aquarium or something, dude. That's a tuna, bro.
No, that was a tuna.
Jay, that's a tuna or something. Jay, look at it. Come on.
Like,
oh, man, we're calling the Coast Guard. Oh, my God.
It turned out to be a sunfish, which they released. But the video seen millions of times. The two appeared on Jimmy Kimmel Live.
Jimmy! Jimmy, what's up, kid?
What's happening?
Oh, man. This is crazy, huh?
Yeah, this is pretty crazy. You guys were out on a boat, and now here you are on television.
Yeah, can you believe this?
So what else happens after a video goes viral? Let's bring in Mikey Bergen's sister turned agent, Leanne. Leanne, what did you think, and what happened after you first saw it?
We went to sleep and woke up, and there were hundreds of thousands of views, tons of comments, and I said, oh, boy, you know. This could be something. Before it went viral, I said, oh, here's Michael again swearing, you know? So to me, it wasn't a surprise.
Well, it's not even just that. It's his wonderful Boston accent.
Right. I think the New Yorker said it best. It said the world looked at Michael Bergen the same way he looked at the fish.
Like, what is this?
Like, I'm seeing something I never saw before.
So let's get going with some of the things that have happened. Because you work in ad sales, you knew of a company that makes T-shirts. Your good friend owns Chowderheads.
Correct.
And so what are some of the T-shirts that you've made?
It's a tuna bro. It's a baby wheel. Call the aquarium and sea monster.
It's a sea monster.
Yeah.
You know, it's very sweet. Your brother alternates between hook 'em, let's hook 'em, and help him. We got to help him.
He has a big heart. He's had a very tough life. He has a past, you know, had a battle with drugs, and he's been sober for almost 3 years now. So when I saw this, I said, wow, this is his opportunity to get some positive attention for the first time in his life. You know, I also wanted to protect my big brother. So I went to work right away and making sure I did that.
Let me ask you about that aspect, because as you well know, a paper in town, the Boston Herald, has reported on your brother's and Jay's criminal past. There's assault and battery convictions, restraining orders. Both were former opiate addicts. Wasn't there a part of you that instead of leaping into the business end of this, maybe wanted to just back out?
Well, we talked about it, you know. My brother hasn't hid who he was through all of this. And I said, listen, guys, this could go away as quickly as it came. You have not been pillars of the community, but everybody gets a second chance in life. Why are you not worthy of blessings?
They continue to come in the form of businesses. Now, first, with the T-shirts, how does that work? You take a cut?
Yes, we take a cut. So
this is your friend at Chowderheads.
Correct. Mm-hmm. I had some ideas, you know, I said, we need a sunfish on a unicycle, on a baby wheel, you know, I trademarked the slogans.
And then there's people from reality shows who've been calling. What have some of the suggestions been?
A lot of the suggestions were, you know, average. You know, let's take Mikey and Jay around the world and show them ridiculous things and get their reaction. And, you know,
it's a pyramid. It's like a pointy thing. What is that thing?
Right. Exactly. And, you know, it's a sick world we live in. This whole criminal background thing, it's actually fueled them. They want them more now, which is... Look, which is why I'm here, because I don't want to see them exploited either.
Well, again, we're talking about what happens after videos, and this is one of the things. I mean, you're walking a fine line. Your brother and his friends are recovering addicts. That's always tenuous. Are you worried that too much wouldn't be worth what might be lost if they can't hold it together?
Well, I know where my brother is in his recovery, and is this a lot? Yeah, it absolutely is, but... opiate addiction is an epidemic, and if Michael can be an example or help people that are also going through the struggle, then I don't think there's something wrong with that. Am I worried for his sobriety? Absolutely. We talk about cyberbullying all the time. For us to spend almost 8 days bringing somebody up to tear them down, I just think it's unfortunate.
Well, so far, though, what's happening is that the calls keep coming. So let's finish with the licensing agreement that you've made with the Hollywood media company, Jukin Media, Inc. They are helping you monetize this video. How so?
So they take care of the licensing, and they also protect and promote the video. Michael still owns the video. However, Jukin can go after infringement. So if somebody then makes a parody of his voice or creates another video that doesn't get Michael's video the view, they go after it. It belongs to Michael. So, you know, we worked out a revenue split. You know, I'm not going to talk about figures, but every click and every license to the video is Michael makes money.
Okay, and you don't want to put a number on that, but is anyone leaving their day job?
Nobody's leaving their day job. Nobody's rich. Unless he gets signed to a big reality show, that's where the money would come in. But for going on a boat with your buddy, he's made more than he had the day before that. Let's just say that.
That's Leanne Bergen. She's the sister, now agent, of Mikey Bergen. She's also a sales rep at Greater Media here in Boston. Leanne, thanks so much and best to you.
Robert, thank you so much for having me.
We're continuing to track Hurricane Joaquin, which is crossing the central and southeastern Bahamas today. Joaquin is now moving northward and picking up speed. Brian Norcross is senior hurricane specialist at the Weather Channel. And Brian, we're now hearing that the hurricane is not expected to make landfall in the U.S. So what can we expect from Joaquin over the next few days?
Well, Joaquin is behaving very well at the moment. It's going to move, we think, with significant confidence. We never say absolutely for sure until it moves on by, but we think with significant confidence that the worst of the hurricane is going to stay offshore of the U.S. and move between the American East Coast and Bermuda on off into the North Atlantic. But as we've been talking about this week, there were actually two weather systems in play, and the one over the East Coast is going to be significant, and I think because it doesn't have a name, that people probably are not paying as much attention to it as they should.
And is that related to the fact that there's a big Category 4 hurricane out there, or is that unrelated?
Well, initially, it's unrelated. The high-pressure system that sprawls across Canada is actually extraordinarily strong. High-pressure system is like a big mound of air, and then you have two low-pressure systems out of the south. One is the hurricane, and another one is over Georgia, South Carolina. And so the air flows between the high, this mountain of air, and the well that is the low-pressure system, and that flowing air is going to just push into the east coast of the U.S. here, and it's going to start later today, peak over the weekend, and last into early next week. So we'll probably have 7 or 8 high tide cycles with this big push of wind pushing the ocean up against the coast. And then on top of that, we're going to have torrential rain, epic rain in some places, we think, in the southeast, concentrated on South Carolina, but affecting North Carolina and a little part of Georgia as well.
Yeah, I've seen reports that there could be 1 to 2 feet of rain in the Carolinas.
That's the forecast. I mean, it's unbelievable. It looks like things are just coming together in just the right way to focus this tropical moisture into South Carolina and the border areas. the hurricane comes into play in that it's part of this big area of low pressure, so that exacerbates the wind, but also some of the moisture feeds out of the hurricane and into the southeast that actually exacerbates the rain. But then as the hurricane moves north and the high pressure moves out of the way, then the wind is actually caused more by the hurricane being well offshore, so it extends the wind event into early next week. So this it's kind of a 1-2-3 thing with three weather systems that all gang up to make an extended period here of nasty weather in the eastern U.S.
And is this likely to be the last hurricane that we see pass by in the Atlantic, or are we still deep into hurricane season?
Well, we're certainly on the downswing here. It's not impossible at all to have October hurricanes. You don't have to think back that far to Hurricane Sandy,
right?
Which certainly was a landmark hurricane. And 10 years ago, Hurricane Wilma came along at the very end of October. So it can happen. It's not my phrase, but it's the right phrase. It's not over until it's over.
Brian Norcross, senior hurricane specialist with the Weather Channel, with an update on Hurricane Joaquin, which looks like it is going to stay out to sea. Although, as Brian says, people along the East Coast, not out of the woods just yet. Brian, thank you so much.
You're very welcome, Jeremy. Thanks.
Cancer was once referred to as the big C. Then along came another C, a miracle, really, chemotherapy. It can attack cancers, prevent them from spreading, but it also has debilitating side effects. Well, now a landmark study sponsored by the National Cancer Institute and published in the New England Journal of Medicine finds that many women with early stage breast cancer can skip chemotherapy without increasing their risk of relapsing or dying from the disease. The study tested a test, Oncotype DX, that predicts how a tumor will respond to treatment and how likely it is to recur, and found that the test can accurately identify patients that don't need chemo. Now, some doctors are taking this news as yet another piece of evidence that we may be over-treating some cancers. Dr. Shelley Wang is chief of breast surgery at Duke University. Dr. Wang, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, Robin.
First of all, tell us, which kind of cancers are we talking about that women may have that means that they don't have to have the chemotherapy?
The type of cancers that this study is looking at are those women who have the most common kind of breast cancer, which is estrogen receptor positive breast cancer. This very special class of tumors tends to be slow growing and therefore tends to benefit less from chemotherapy. They are driven by estrogens, and so the strategy is that by depleting estrogens from these tumors, we can slow down growth and hopefully prevent any mortality from these cancers.
And these are the kinds of cancers that are most likely to respond to a hormone blocking drug, a drug that would block the estrogen that's fueling the cancer.
Yes, absolutely. And the question in this study was, if we took a group of women who had these very favorable prognosis tumors, we might be able to choose a group of women who respond so well to endocrine therapy alone that we can omit chemotherapy as part of their treatment.
Yeah. Now, talk about the test, Oncotype DX. It's been around since 2004. What it does is it measures the genes that control cell growth, and it can tell you what the response would be to that hormone therapy treatment that we talked about.
Yes, I think importantly, it measures genes that determine the aggressive nature of the tumor, and it gives us some indication as to which tumors may have a good enough prognosis even without chemotherapy.
And by the way, when a woman who has an early stage cancer that we now know, if she'd been tested by this Oncotype DX, she would know that she could maybe use an estrogen blocking drug as opposed to chemotherapy.
Yes, and the standard treatment now is to, for many patients, is to give endocrine therapy and chemotherapy for patients who are either intermediate risk or high risk. But what this study shows us is that if patients are very low risk, at 5 years, patients have less than a 2% chance of recurrence even without chemotherapy.
Right.
So I think this just confirms what we've always wanted to do, is let the biology drive some of the treatment decisions rather than just recommend the same treatment for everybody. It's kind of like a Goldilocks phenomenon where you don't want to give too little and have a high recurrence rate. You don't want to give too much and have patients suffer incredible toxicities from treatment. We need to nail the treatment so that we're treating patients with just the right amount of therapy and balancing the trade-offs of treatment with the benefits.
Right. And my question is, if that woman who doesn't need the chemotherapy has the chemotherapy, just remind us, I mean, chemotherapy, you take the drugs in through an IV as opposed to radiation where the radiation is targeted on a cell. Why is it important to know that a woman doesn't need the chemotherapy? What can happen to her if she has it and doesn't need it?
Yes. Yeah, so first of all, chemotherapy is used to treat a wide variety of cancers, and the side effects from chemotherapy have never been as treatable as they are now. Nevertheless, it's still used to treat a large variety of tumors, including breast cancer. As you say, it's a medication that generally goes in through an IV. It's given over 4 to 6 months generally. And the side effects that patients have, they can tell you very well. The first thing is they lose their hair. There still can be nausea, fatigue, lots of side effects, including neuropathies, where patients have numbness in their hands and their feet. And then there can be long-term side effects as well. And I think those are toxicities that if the chemotherapy is beneficial, many patients are willing to undergo. Certainly many of us recommend it. But if they're really not going to benefit substantially, then those are toxicities that the patient doesn't have to be exposed
right.
to.
Right. Again, but still a miracle. But why do it?
Absolutely.
If you, yeah, why do it? If you
yes,
don't
we
have
need
to,
to be. We right. need to be much smarter about who we give the treatments to. And I think this study gives us much confidence in the community about moving forward with letting the biology of the tumor drive the treatment decisions that we make.
Okay, that's the doctors. What about the patients? I mean, isn't this asking a woman to really go against what she's learned over the past several decades, you know, to say no to chemotherapy? Is that, have you had women balk at that?
I think it's really important for the public to know that even when patients follow all the recommendations that physicians give you, there's always a chance of recurrence. And there are certainly patients who decline any of the treatments that we offer them and still do very well. And we are really at the beginning of trying to understand which kinds of tumors may benefit from very little treatment and for which tumors you need to intervene early and aggressively. This is one step in very much the right direction. But I think patients need to understand that all the treatments we give them are meant to cure. But in the end, all the treatments just give what's called a proportional risk reduction. It reduces the chance that the cancer is going to come back. But much of what we do doesn't eliminate that risk completely. So those patients who were in the study, about 2% who did have a recurrence, need to understand that even if they'd had chemotherapy, that may not have prevented them from having that recurrence. And as a society, as stakeholders in this, we all need to be very comfortable with accepting that risk.
Yeah. Do you worry, or have you had women worry, that because of that test, they may not have the option of asking for the chemotherapy as well? And they may want to. I mean, you know, insurance companies may say, look, we've got this test. Why are we covering chemotherapy anymore?
So I think what's really important to keep in mind is that the decisions about treatment, particularly for breast cancer, where I think we're really far ahead of many other kinds of cancers, it involves a very thoughtful conversation between the patient and physician, and it also requires some understanding of the kind of risk that you're comfortable taking on in your life. There may be many women out there who are willing to take any sort of treatment, including chemotherapy, for even a very small increase in benefit. So there are lots of treatments that we give for maybe a 1 or 2% benefit in mortality. And for some women, the toxicities of treatment are worth that, and I think that's absolutely the right decision for them.
Yeah.
But I think this gives us evidence about what would happen if they didn't have chemotherapy. And this allows us to be a little bit more courageous about thinking about taking some of those treatments, making them less critically important as part of the treatment for these patients. I think there will always be patients who want to do the most, getting chemotherapy, getting a double mastectomy. But I think it's really in the context of fear. And I think if we're able to provide data which gives them some idea of how small the benefit might be from some of the very aggressive treatments that are part of what is offered, then they might choose to make different decisions.
Yeah. Well, we're reading the comments from people who were involved with the study. The people who had the low risk scores with the Oncotype test did extraordinarily well at 5 years, you know, after not having the chemotherapy and just having the hormone blocker. One doctor, Dr. Hope Rugo, is saying there's no chance that those patients would have had any benefit with chemotherapy, and they're doing well without it. Another woman who was afraid of the complications of chemo, took the test, and scored very low on the recurrence risk, and so she was advised to go without the chemotherapy. She was thrilled. She's been fine. Pretty exciting. Pretty exciting results.
Yeah, very exciting, and I think it points to the promise of precision therapy, where we really allow the attributes of a tumor, the tumor biology, to give us information on the kinds of treatments that may most benefit these patients. What this means is that we'll be able to pick out those patients who have the most aggressive tumors and treat them aggressively, as we have been doing. But I think it also gives us evidence to start cutting back on some of the very toxic treatments we've been offering to patients. And I think the future is very bright in that we'll continue to have these sorts of advances with the commitment of all the stakeholders that are involved in this discussion. Yeah.
That's Dr. Shelley Huang, surgical oncologist and chief of breast surgery at Duke University and Duke Cancer Institute in North Carolina. Dr. Huang, okay. Thank you so much, and thank you for your work.
It's been a pleasure talking to you, Robin. Thank you very much.
So your thoughts, will you be worried to forego the chemo or grateful? Or have you already confronted this? Let us know at hereandnow.org.
Today in Cleveland, a 3-month exhibit is opening to remind people of the horrors of the Holocaust through a collection of string instruments that have been mostly silent for the last 7 decades. The Violins of Hope were once owned by the inmates of Nazi concentration camps. David C. Barnett from Here and Now contributor WCPN in Cleveland has the story behind the instruments.
Clevelander Stanley Bernath got his first look at the Mauthausen concentration camp in Austria through the slats of a cattle car in 1944. A teenager at the time, Bernath says he and his fellow Jewish prisoners were yanked off the train. Some were beaten, others shot as they marched to the front gate.
As we entered, a symphonic orchestra was playing Beethoven. It was an unbelievable sight. People were being killed and beaten, and there's an orchestra playing.
That's a story that Israeli violin maker Amnon Weinstein has heard before. The first time was 50 years ago when a man brought a battered old instrument into his shop in Tel Aviv and told Weinstein the violin had once been played in a death camp.
It took me time to begin to touch something like that, and I asked him a lot of questions. And from him I know a lot of things about how they played, where they played and everything. One violin that I got it in the beginning, I was very afraid of that. I did it, and I didn't want to continue. I could not. Because first of all, when I opened this violin, there was a black powder inside, which for me was from the ashes. And I know it from the man who played on it. He played on the way to the gas chamber.
For Weinstein, that instrument was a chilling reminder of all the relatives he had lost in those prison camps. And for the last 20 years, he's been on a quest to collect and repair violins of the Holocaust.
Okay.
Weinstein's Tel Aviv shop is filled with violins, violas, and cellos in various states of repair. And he reckons he's restored about 60 instruments so far. About a third of his collection, called the Violins of Hope, has come to Cleveland for an exhibition at the Maltz Museum of Jewish Heritage. Weinstein is pleased that hundreds of people will get the chance to see these historic instruments up close. But he's really excited about a series of concerts in which performers will play his restored violins.
Violin have to speak. And the most important part of the life of a violin is to be played in concert. And then they can tell stories. You can hear history.
A scratchy 1944 Nazi propaganda film of a staged concert at Theresienstadt in Czechoslovakia is one of the few recordings of music performed in a concentration camp. Jay Geller says the ability to play an instrument saved some prisoners from the gas chambers. Geller is co-teaching a class in Holocaust art and history at Case Western Reserve University this fall.
Being a musician and selected to play in a camp orchestra was a highly prized position. They were, if you will, the prize cattle.
Peter Otto was one of 21 members of the Cleveland Orchestra who got to play one of the Violins of Hope in concert this past weekend. For Otto, the relationship between a musician and his or her instrument is deeply personal. He rested the scroll of the violin gently against his cheek and tried to imagine its previous owner.
I'm right now holding something in my hand that someone at some point cared very deeply for, and that hopefully gave this person some sort of, I don't want to say peace, but even if it's just a way to express their suffering.
For Amnon Weinstein, each violin is like a memorial.
If to one part of my family, or memorial for the 6 million people, but this is a forest of sounds for all those people. And this is very, very important.
And Weinstein says that's why he continues to look for more violins to bring back to life.
Now the next step is going to close it.
For Here and Now, I'm David C. Barnett in Cleveland.
Sounds like a very powerful exhibit in Cleveland.
I needed that.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.